How do you honor God? By doing everything to the glory of God. Not just not sinning, not just, okay, you don't steal from people, but by making good shoes.
If we're going to talk about you were a new creation, that means everything has to change.
Why does God not just, you know, bring people to heaven immediately after being saved? It's because there's stuff to do here. There's a point to all of this. And if we're Christians, we do it better, or at least in theory.
But if we really apply the standard that's set in Scripture, then we know that no one is good because no one is God.
We serve a storyteller. We serve a God who has a perfect plan, a sovereign will for every moment of history.
It's not about going into the world to make artists. It's about going into the world to make disciples.
This is The Christian Artist, Honoring Christ Through Creativity. My name is Caleb.
And my name is Carly.
And we are back once more to talk about Ghibli. So we actually watched this one again. As I think I've said on these episodes before, we started watching these Ghibli films a few months ago and then realized, oh, hey, we should make podcast episodes about them. And so I've been going back through them. Some of them just watching like recap videos to refresh ourselves, but been a couple like Nausicaa and this one, Kiki's Delivery Service, that we've watched again because they're just so good.
A wholesome movie.
Yeah, very wholesome movie. Story follows Kiki, a young witch who moves to a new town and uses her flying ability to earn a living. Right? She's a witch on a broom, and she has a delivery service because she can fly. And honestly, like it's slice of life, like most Miyazaki films are. But the, I was actually definitely more impressed with the plot this time around than I was maybe the first time. I thought through, I think, a little bit more the actual arc that she was going on, and it made a little bit more sense to me the second time we watched it. I really enjoyed this film. It's just, I mean, as Carly was saying, it's really wholesome. The world building is really fun. Mm-hmm. So it is an alternate 1950s where the world wars never happened. Mm-hmm. So
in
it's
a
in Europe.
European city that's based off of like Stockholm and several other European cities, like I think what's the one I'm thinking of? The one Italian city.
Milan.
That was one of them. I think there was another one, but I can't remember the name of it off the top of my head for some reason. But yeah, several different European cities. The animation of the architecture of the city is so pretty, so pleasing to look at.
Yep. I don't know. What were your first impressions of or general thoughts about the movie besides what we've already discussed? Obviously the setting's really fun, but
mm-hmm. Yeah, I just tend to love stories like this, typically more in the TV show format where you know, this is comparable to me to the type of format of shows like Lark Rise the Candleford and All Creatures Great and Small.
Yeah, it definitely does have a feel like that.
It's just like it's someone mostly focused on one character in a town or a city that's like running a business, and you just get to see their like day to day, like these are the different customers that they're dealing with and stuff like that. Like it's and their interactions with other people in the town. Like it's just, that's the kind of stuff that's really like cozy, and fun for me to watch. And so it was kind of cool to have an animated movie in that format. That was just really cute and cozy. And obviously there were conflict points in the movie, but for the most part, it was just really enjoyable. We didn't really have to think too much about, oh, how's she going to solve this problem? It was kind of just like enjoying being along for the ride.
Yeah. So this movie is based on an original children's fantasy novel by the same name, Kiki's Delivery Service, in Japanese originally. So it's by Aiko Kadano. And they changed a lot of things for the movie, particularly anything that has to do with an actual plot is imported into the from not from the book, but just made for the movie specifically. So let me find this little section I was reading. Let's see. Many of the more dramatic elements, such as Kiki getting attacked by crows, losing her powers, or the airship incident at the film's climax, are not present in the original story. In order to more clearly illustrate the themes of struggling with independence and growing up in the film, Miyazaki intended to have Kiki face tougher challenges and create a more potent sense of loneliness. So I really think that makes it much better.
It sounds like the book was even, or the story was even more slice of life than than this was.
Yeah, I think the closest she gets in the book, from what I'm reading here, is her broom breaks at one point, and so she can't fly, but she just has to fix it, and she's fine. So, yeah, I mean, it's a slice of life film, but it's certainly way better in terms of plot than something like Totoro. It has a very clear plot. I mean, literally from the very beginning, the moment on this second watch through that helped key in place like the whole arc for me was when she meets the witch on her way to the city for the first time, and basically she says, the witch says, you know, I make my living doing fortune telling, like that's my skill, what's your skill? And Kiki has to think about that, and she doesn't know the answer. She's like, I don't know what my skill is yet. And so it's like, oh yeah, Kiki has to like figure out who she is as a witch, learn and grow, become more independent, and by the end of the film, she flight is her skill, right? Like that's the thing she figures out, that this is what I'm good at, more than anything else. I guess I've done a little bit of minor spoiling at this point. I would check it out. It's a really fantastic film, especially I would say for girls, a good strong female lead, but a very feminine female lead, right?
Yeah. It's so sweet at the beginning of the movie where it's kind of funny too, where her mom's like getting her ready to leave home and go find the city that she's gonna live and train in, and she's like putting her in this black dress, and Kiki's like, I would look so much better in lilac or pink. And her mom's like, oh, this is the color that witches wear.
Yeah, that's actually another thing that's kind of a theme in the movie is the transition from traditional to contemporary, right? So she observes the tradition of witches wearing black, but she has a big bright red bow as part of like her own kind of independence from that. She flies her mother's old broom. She bakes in a wood burning stove. Like but it's a good balance of aspects between an appreciation for tradition and a, like, I'm going to be my own person and like actually find what interests me and like what my like evolution from this might look like in a very wholesome way, right? Like that sort of story has been done to death in, especially with female leads, and it can usually be very cringy, but this is very wholesome and balanced. I mean, so the setting, she's a witch. It's never really explained what that means, except for the fact that like most of the stereotypes of witches, you can do potions, you can do fortune telling, you can fly in a broom, you have a black cat. And apparently each city or town has their own witch. Or at least there's like one witch per settlement. But I mean, that's the sort of like subtle world building that Miyazaki does in Studio Ghibli in general does best, where it's all of the world building is implied rather than explicit, explicitly stated. So I really think they offered pretty much all they needed to in terms of the explanation for like why witches are a thing and what's going on, because it seemed like people knew what witches were, but this city hadn't seen one in a long time. So, oh, it cool. You can fly on a broom. That's neat. The setting is just really fun in this movie. We mentioned it's alternate 1950s where the world wars didn't happen, and it really feels like that for sure. Technology isn't quite as 1950s as it should be, which makes sense given if you don't have the world wars, you don't have as quick advancement of technology. the like big thing is like airships.
Mm-hmm.
In this setting. It's a big deal when the dirigible starts flying or whatever, right? Which, you know, by 1950s, you have aircraft carriers and fighter jets and things, right? Like, or like the beginnings of those. But yeah, I mean, it feels really, the setting feels like it, the World Wars didn't happen. It's way more wholesome.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
than even our 1950s was.
Might have been.
Yeah, especially for Europe, right? Like 1950s Europe was a very different place than this movie implies it to be. So it's a very, very kind of wholesome rural atmosphere, which, yeah, totally lines up with the setting they wanted to make up. We're kind of doing scattershot here. Anything else that we can think of in terms of setting? That's fun to talk about. Again, most of it's implied rather than explicitly explored. There's a whole thing that it's really funny. There's like one line in the movie. So she gets attacked by crows at one point, and her talking magical cat says, crows used to serve witches. You should just start ordering them around or something along those lines. And Kiki says, well, it's been a long time since then. Mm-hmm. And that's all we ever hear about the crow army that witches apparently used to summon. But it's like statements like that that really fill in the minor details of the world building that help us believe this is a real setting with
it. It makes it clear that the builders of the world know what they're talking about when they're talking about the world, but the viewer doesn't have to know everything.
Yep. It's a classic thing.
You just
thing.
Trust that, oh yeah, this makes sense.
Yep. It's a classic world builder's trick to give you a concrete detail about a minor thing.
Mm-hmm.
So that you think as a reader or a watcher or whatever, right? As the audience, oh, they thought of that thing? Well, then they must know all the other stuff. Yeah. And you don't even have to know all the other stuff, but as long as you get that one little thing right, the rest of it kind of in your imagination falls into place in the background. So that it was a good moment. Has good world building like that. She has a talking cat named Gigi. And one of the interesting things that I forgot about even before we, like, just reading this article on it, on the movie, is that Gigi stops talking and never starts talking again.
Yeah.
And apparently that's, from Miyazaki, that's supposed to be, Gigi is representing the immature side of Kiki, is like her imaginary friend. Mm. It's implied that maybe cats don't actually talk, and that was just her imagining that he's talking to her
whole
time.
Yeah.
Which, you know, who knows? I don't know. It's not explicitly stated one way or the other.
Yeah.
But either way, she kind of like grows into maturity and doesn't need Gigi anymore. That's the implication that's being given. Fun character, fun snarky comments from the cat that are fun to see. In general, good characterization. I mean, we should talk about the characters now, actually. We should talk about Asano.
Mm-hmm.
Do you want to talk about Asano?
That's the bakery owner, right?
Baker lady.
Yeah. Yep. She's great. She's pregnant for the majority of the film. And she just, like, runs a bakery with her husband and is super wholesome. And she, like, has a spare room and gives it to Kiki for simply, like, helping out around the bakery and stuff. Super, super wholesome, like, just neighbors bartering for things that'll help them out and everything. Yeah,
Kiki is like, oh man, I gotta save up money to buy a phone so I can do my delivery service.
Yeah, she
service.
Helps and her start like, run her business.
No, just use our phone.
Yeah,
super wholesome. I mean, again, Ghibli does a great job of gender role proper, like the proper representation of gender roles and masculinity and femininity and the ways those are balanced and wholesome. And, you know, even though Asano is the character that we, like, she's the one who does most of the talking, her husband's the strong, silent type, it never comes across as if she's, like, the matriarch of the family. She's just a hospitable, happy, pregnant woman.
Yeah.
Who, obviously, she's going to talk more to Kiki than her husband would, because they're both gals. And just, yeah, just generally, just all around, super wholesome character, very feminine, matronly character.
Yeah, and there's one point at which the husband makes, like, I'm assuming it was made out of bread, because that's what it seems like, and he's a baker, but he makes, like a bread wreath with, like, a little witch on a broom with a cat to advertise her delivery service, and puts it in the window. And there's a cute moment of her just, like, running and hugging him and thanking him. So there's several moments like that where you get moments from the husband that are, like, not spoken about, but you see them and it's like, oh, okay, yeah, he is also involved in being hospitable to this girl, just in a very different way than his wife is.
Let's see. We got Tombo as well. Very wholesome character. I think you were talking when we were watching the film, how Tombo's a really good representation of what a masculine pursuit looks like.
Yeah. Because at first, Kiki's really annoyed that he's trying to spend time with her.
Yep.
But he still keeps trying to hang out with her and, like, asks her to a dance and everything. And he does it in a way that's not obnoxious and overbearing. Like, I know,
very confident and assertive. Yes, and yeah.
There's this idea in a lot of conservative and even conservative Christian circles that's like, oh, if a girl's annoyed by you, you can just keep pushing and eventually she'll marry you. And it's like, no, that's not like, you can get branded as a stalker for that, first of all, or just arrogant, or, you know, things that are going to make you more disliked by women. But you can do it in a way, you can pursue a woman in a way like he does in the movie, that's confident and is still gentle and not overbearing, not creepy, not like, I will have you type of way.
Yeah. No, and the thing with Tombo, right, is that, I mean, and you know, they're young, she's like 13 in the movie. So it's not like it's overtly like courting her, but it's still, I mean, that it's, again, like most Miyazaki films, it's implied where this ends. Right. More than anything. It's a very, clearly masculine, feminine, interested in each other sort of progression. But yeah, I mean, I think Tombo's a great character because this character, I feel like Miyazaki can get away with a lot of things. An American movie with a character like this would probably be branded as, oh, he should just leave her. Or let's say not a movie, a real person who does what he does in our day and age would be branded as arrogant and stuck up and just leave her alone. She said, no, dude, like, leave her alone. And he's like, no, I did nothing wrong. I'm just trying to be nice. Like, I'm being friendly. I'm interested in her. I'm going to continue to pursue her. It's like, I'm going to figure out, like, what's wrong? Like, what did I do anything? Like, actually, like, asking her good questions, continuing to be friendly to her and wanting to be interested in what she's doing, in a way that eventually wins her over, right?
I think a good counterexample to Tombo's character would be Jess in Gilmore Girls.
Yeah.
Oh, where Jess is the worst. Just keeps pushing and pushing and trying to get closer to her, even though she's in a relationship. And then that relationship eventually breaks up and he still ends up coming back at some point and being like, clearly you want to be with me. And she's like, no, go away.
Yep. Yeah, so great characters. There's a gal in the woods. I can't remember her name.
Yeah, the painter.
I don't remember
what her name was either.
Ursula? That sound right? Fukuo? No, Fukuo is the guy. Is the husband. I think it might be Ursula. I'm looking at the voice cast here, and I think that's it's like an order of importance. So I think that's what her name is. I kept waiting for her to secretly be a witch, but she.
Yeah, that was my expectation too, especially because she had this affinity with the crows.
And they made that comment. Yeah.
Yeah.
It seems like something that probably should have come up.
Ursula.
Yeah, yeah. And she was a great character. Like, she had a lot of really good moments. She helped Kiki, like, figure out, like, how to get her magic back. Like, there's a whole big thing there. I just wish she would have mattered slightly more in the plot.
Yeah, she seemed like she was there to help Kiki solve that issue. But other than that, she was kind of just there to be a unique character.
Yeah. Oh, let's see. Any other characters that we need to mention? There's a good moment between... I don't know if we ever get names for these characters, but there's an older woman who is trying to bake a treat for her granddaughter, and that's one of the things that Kiki has to deliver. And, you know, it's not ready yet. She helps her bake it in the oven, the stone oven. There's a whole big thing there. And then shows up with it, and the granddaughter, like, is like, this is so gross. Like, why does my grandmother keep baking this for me? And then later on, Tombo turns out to be friends with that girl, and Kiki is turned off by that and just walks away because she's so, like, disgusted with the way that that girl acted. And it's a fun little cycle there of just, like, Kiki's, like, wholesomeness and kindness in and the way that she cares for people and has been taught to care for people by her parents. Yeah. So there's a lot of moments like that in the film that are just really wholesome and don't have as much, like, direct relevance to the plot so much as just help. They help Kiki figure, because, like, the plot is basically Kiki needs to grow up. It's a coming of age story, right? Mm-hmm. She needs to figure out what it means to be a witch, what it means for her to be away from her parents in a new place, what she actually wants from life, what she's good at, how she can be good at those things without, you know, burning herself out or, you know, so on and so forth. Lots of different things she needs to learn just about being an adult. Which brings us to, I think we should probably go here, brings us to the end of the story. So the climax is basically, you know, Tombo is really interested in aviation and is enamored by Kiki as a result because she can fly with a broom. And there's a whole moment where he goes to see the big... actually, yeah, this is directly relevant. I'm realizing now she was going to go see the dirigible with him if that girl hadn't been with him, right? Because that kind of ruined it, soured it for her. And so she leaves, and then they go to see the dirigible take off. And then something happens with the dirigible, the airship... is not working. It starts tipping into the air and like floating away with a powerful wind. And Tombo is holding onto the rope, trying to keep it down with, like, a whole bunch of other people. And he ends up flying through the air on the rope, hanging on for dear life as the thing is blown around. And then Kiki has to, you know, step up. She has lost her flight at this point, and so she's
has to figure out how to get back.
She has to figure out how to get. Yeah, she has to, like, yeah, figure out how to get back and go save Tombo. I really like this sequence because it doesn't feel to me like the girl has to save the boy and that's what the story is about. That's not the point of it. Like, she's good at a thing and she has found a way and she has to, like, mature to the point where she can use that thing to say to like protect and help the people she loves. And the moment is less about saving Tombo and more about Kiki coming into her own as a witch, and kind of, like, deciding what she cares about, deciding that she needs to be an adult, and, you know, grow up and do what she needs to do to, and, you know, stop moping around. All those things kind of come to a head. And then she goes and saves Tombo. And I got choked up a little bit watching it the second time. It's such the way they frame it is such a good image. With, you know, her, the very last moment, she's holding onto her broom with one hand and reaches down and grabs him. And there's a moment where they're like hanging in midair, and it's good visuals. One of the funny things in the behind the scenes that I saw here is that in the original dub, the one that Disney did that we listened to, there's two versions of it. The first version of it that they came out with first added a whole bunch of music and sound effects and extra lines and had Gigi talk at the very end to be like, oh, no, he is talking to her and she's everything's back to normal. And then apparently they went back on it for the 2010 version of it they made. It's the same voice actors and stuff, but they went back through the and took out all of the, they had like dubbed in English songs. They had like done a whole bunch of stuff to it, and they went back and made it way more like the original Japanese dub. They put the Japanese songs back. They took out a bunch of the extraneous sound effects. And as I was reading through this, like all the things they did with the dub, and I was like, I don't remember any of this. And it's because, and then I saw that they had gone back to that 2010 version. And I was like, oh, that makes so much more sense. Because there's several moments, the moment we just described at the climax being one of them, where there's just silence. It's literally just silence. There's no sound effects. There's no music. There's nothing. And it's Kiki. What, say again?
I hadn't noticed that.
Yeah, so there's two moments in particular that stand out to me. One, when Kiki has to, you know, grabs the broom from the random janitor or whatever and stands there and has to like get her magic back. There's a moment where it's just silence, and then we see the bristles go live, and then she zooms away. And then there's the moment where she saves Tombo. There's just silence. And they grab, right? She grabs his hand. And I think it definitely would be overstating it to add things to that sequence. I think Miyazaki knew what he was doing with the sound design there.
Yeah. Or
whoever did the sound design under Miyazaki's direction. I think it's a really good film. I mean, Miyazaki films are great. Ghibli films are always great in general. This is one of my favorites for sure. It's certainly my favorite of the ones I hadn't already watched when we started this run through. Really, really enjoy it.
Yeah. One of the things that I was just thinking about and comparing to the other movies that we've watched is this might be a Japanese culture thing compared to American. I'm not sure. It might just be the time period that most of these movies were made in. But there's definitely a theme of like, okay, you've hit what most Americans would call adolescence, and now it's time to be an adult. Like there's definitely less that theme of like, oh, you get to be a teenager for a time. It's just like, okay, you went from being a child to now you have to learn how to be an adult. This movie is a really good example of that, as well as, I mean, most of the characters that are younger, that are kids, which is most of the movie's main protagonists, are on the younger end of the teen spectrum, if not even teenagers yet. And there's lots of themes of kind of figuring out independence, some of which in like Grave of the Fireflies, that's like kind of forced independence. And some of it, it's just like, no, this is what you do at this point of your life, even when you don't necessarily have to do it to survive. So that's a realization I just made, but that's been really refreshing watching these movies and seeing like, oh yeah, like the American ideal of adolescence and being a moody teenager doesn't actually have to be set in stone.
Yep.
Again, I don't know if that was a cultural thing or just a time period difference of like where we were when those movies were made versus where we are now. But
yeah, I mean, honestly, that's one of the things I do like about Kiki's is she's literally 13 years old and goes off to live in a random city by herself.
And her parents are like, Well, yeah, you weren't planning on doing this for another month, and so that's why it feels a little early, but
yeah,
but we trust that you can do this still.
Yep. And to be honest, I think most 13-year-olds, if they had been properly raised, could.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely.
Right?
Yeah.
Maybe not in our society per se, because of the way it's set up. Like, you can't even get a job at 13, right?
Yeah.
But in a world without those status restrictions on children, who they consider children, quote unquote, mm-hmm. right? Minors. 13-year-olds are way more capable than you're giving them credit for being.
Yeah.
And they don't have to be, they have hormones, of course, but it turns out proper parenting can really direct those hormones in the right way.
Yeah.
So.
Turns out it's probably more helpful for them to be learning how to become an adult while they're learning to manage those hormones, as opposed to just being told, oh, you're a teenager, you're just going to be dealing with those mood swings.
Turns out the hormones are there for a reason, and if you can mm-hmm. harness the hormones instead of trying to simultaneously encourage and shut any possibility of using them out. Yeah. Anyway, that's a whole nother conversation.
Yeah. yeah, that's just something I was noticing, especially from this movie, that I was like, that's refreshing to see, because you don't see that in many American movies, especially nowadays. Yep.
Yeah, funny thing, the only actor I recognize from the Disney dub that we listened to is Kirsten Dunst plays Kiki. I don't know if we looked that up the first time we watched it. But
I think so.
Yeah, Kirsten Dunst. She does a great job. It's a great dub. Let's see, are there any other behind-the-scenes stuff that are fun to bring up? I think I brought up most of them.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, I was a good host. I've been sprinkling in all the behind the scenes stuff I read up on the entire time. Yeah, great film. I don't know if there's anything in particular to bring up about Japanese versus American culture, which is one thing we've been bringing up with these films. There's not much of that here. It's based on an imaginary Europe. It is interesting though that all the characters have like Japanese names, but they're supposed to be in like Stockholm or whatever, right? Yeah, yeah. I don't really know how this all works out exactly, but I don't think about it too much.
Mm-hmm.
It works fine. It's an anime. You kind of expect them to have Japanese names. I don't know if there's a whole lot else to bring up. I'm thinking that honestly, for the next couple films, we should probably double up. So we have more to say in one episode. There's a couple of these that were fine, but
a lot of them we've touched on aspects of already, just in talking earlier movies. So there won't be quite as much to go deep on.
Because, okay, so next we have Only Yesterday. I don't know if there's a whole episode's worth to talk about for Only Yesterday, but the issue is the next one is Porco Rosso, which I do think there is a whole episode's worth to talk about for that one. Let's see. Okay, so we have Only Yesterday, Porco Rosso, Pom Poko, Whisper of the Heart are the next four. I'm wondering if we do... because like Porco Rosso, I want to do a full episode on.
Mm-hmm.
Princess Mononoke, I want to do a full episode on. But the other movies up to where we, because that'll be up to where we've watched. Only Yesterday, Pom Poko, Whisper of the Heart, and My Neighbors the Yamadas. We can probably do two per episode.
Mm-hmm.
Like do two episodes for all four of those.
Yeah.
How do we want to pair those up, you think? Live on air scheduling.
Do you want to do Porco Rosso first next week and then do Only Yesterday and Pom Poko and then the other two together?
Yeah, let's do this. We'll do Porco Rosso next week, Only Yesterday and Pom Poko and then Princess Mononoke the week after that, and then Whisper of the Heart and My Neighbor the Yamadas.
Mm-hmm.
Right?
Yeah.
I think that'll be good. Sounds great. Porco Rosso is another great film. I'm excited to watch that one again. I definitely want to watch that one again. That's a very good film. But yeah, I think we'll probably wrap it up there and then come back next week and talk more about these Ghibli films. I'm sure at some point we'll take a break from this and do something else or take a week off or something. But for now on, we'll just, or for right now, we're just plowing through. We're getting very close to episode 200, which I think we were planning on doing like a game show thing again for that one. I'll have to get in touch with Connor and see if we can figure out a time to schedule that one. I think that would be still fun to do. So, all righty. Well, there you go. That's been The Christian Artist. I need to write up a new spiel. Let me look at these links. You can find me anywhere on the internet with the handle Caleb M. Powers. That's where I am everywhere. You can also get to the Patreon at patreon.com/CalebMPowers. Support the podcast and all the other shows we do on this channel and the other places this streams to. You can check out my website, CalebMPowers.com. And there is a link in the liner notes to our Discord, our community Discord, where you can hang out and talk Studio Ghibli or whatever else you would like to discuss. I think that is it for us today. We'll be back next week with some more Ghibli. Adios.